Brandy Renee Hannah had gone through a difficult breakup. She had chosen to leave her fiancé of 6 years and to strike out with another man who had captured her attention and her heart. Leaving behind the comforts of her home, Brandy and her new boyfriend decided to get an apartment together in the Chicora Cherokee neighborhood of North Charleston, South Carolina. It wasn't a great area, but it was close to the restaurant where Brandy worked as a waitress alongside her mother, Donna. Her new boyfriend, Zeke, had other plans though, and left Brandy just shortly after moving in together. Heartbroken and on her own, Brandy planned to make the best of things. She stayed in touch with Zeke, who she believed would come back to her, while also fielding calls from her previous ex, Ray McAdams, who was desperate to get her back into his life. On the afternoon of Friday, May 20th, Brandy left her job in the early afternoon with plans of spending the weekend at the beach and clearing her head. When no one heard from Brandy for the next few days, there was concern, but it was believed she was at the beach and just trying to take some time for herself. However, when she failed to arrive at work the following Monday morning and her apartment was quiet and dark, friends and family knew something was wrong. Over the next 14 years, investigators will receive tips and clues, find themselves caught in the middle of a love triangle, and ultimately lose one suspect to a heart attack while compiling evidence against another. Call logs reveal lies told by a suspect, and charges of obstruction of justice will be levied against a man believed to know more than he has shared. What happened to Brandy Hanna? And does one of the men who claim to have loved her know exactly where the young woman has been concealed? This is Trace Evidence, Episode 69, The Disappearance of Brandy Hanna. Welcome to Trace Evidence. I'm your host, Stephen Pacheco. Today we examine the disturbing disappearance of 32-year-old Brandy Hanna. Before getting into the case, just a few notes about the show. Trace Evidence is a weekly true crime podcast focused on unsolved murders and disappearances, examining a different case each Monday. If you have questions, comments, or case suggestions, email me at traceevidencepod@gmail.com. Follow me on Twitter at @TraceEvPod, on Instagram at @TraceEvidencePod, or join the Facebook discussion group simply by searching for Trace Evidence. You can visit the website at trace-evidence.com for full episodes, social media links, merchandise, and much more. Trace Evidence is also on Patreon, so if you would like to support the show, please visit patreon.com/traceevidence, where you can get rewards such as stickers, pins, and commercial-free episodes. There's also a PayPal donation link on the website for those of you who don't wish to go through Patreon. This show is a complete one-man operation, and your support is greatly appreciated. This week we examine the 2005 disappearance of Brandy Hanna from North Charleston, South Carolina. It's a disturbing case with a lot of rumors, a few clues, and two suspects that grab everyone's attention. This is episode 69, The Disappearance of Brandy Hanna. Brandy Renee was born on November 16, 1972, to mother Donna Hanna, later Donna Parent. As Parent's first child and her only daughter, Donna was absolutely in love with her little girl from the very first day. Born into a caring and supportive family, Brandy would ultimately spend a large portion of her childhood living with and being raised by extended family, including aunts and uncles. Through the help of family and with the unconditional love of Donna, Brandy found herself in a world surrounded by those who loved and cared for her. This world would expand later when two younger brothers Shane, and Michael came along. The beautiful blonde-haired, blue-eyed girl was quickly a head-turner. There were few who could be around the child and not immediately feel smitten. Drawing others to her with a charismatic flair benefited a young Brandy who was, by all accounts, incredibly shy, but also fun and exciting to be around. Friend Robin Pyle would later describe Brandy by saying, quote, "She could make something that the normal person would find ordinary into something super fantastic and fun. She was very creative." End quote. This creativity would serve Brandy well and contributed a great deal to her artistic talent. Whenever she had a free moment and a pencil, Brandy could always be found drawing and sketching. Brandy was defined by many as a tomboy. She loved being outside, playing, getting dirty, and having a good time. Athletic and developing into a strong young woman, Brandy was a force to be reckoned with, and yet she also possessed a quiet, shy, and sensitive side. She was funny and eclectic, while simultaneously caring, sweet, and loving, much like the family she'd grown up with. It would be Brandy's love of excitement, adventure, and physical activity that would later drive her to join in the Reserve Officers Training Corps, or ROTC, while in high school. While she spent a lot of time living with relatives, her relationship with her mother was incredibly strong. As she aged, their relationship continued to grow, and many would describe them as best friends. Donna took her role as a mother seriously, but also couldn't help but be charmed by Brandy, as most people who met her were. Their relationship was strong. There was nothing Brandy didn't share with her mother, and she was, in many ways, her rock, the one constant in her life, the one person she could always depend on. And while this was true for Brandy, it also worked the same way for Donna. Much of Brandy's life revolved around North Charleston, South Carolina, the third largest city in the state. Located to the north of its sister city, North Charleston covers more than 76 square miles and boasts a population of nearly 100,000 residents. North Charleston is a dynamic location with a culturally diverse makeup, consisting predominantly of African American and Caucasians who combine to create more than 80% of the population. Suffice it to say, Brandy was exposed to all manner and class of individuals, and much like many other larger cities, North Charleston had areas of beautiful multi-million-dollar homes situated in quiet neighborhoods, contrasted by lower-income housing and less inviting areas with higher crime rates. Brandy's mother worked as a waitress at a local restaurant called Alex's, located on Dorchester Road. When Brandy was 16, she began to feel the pressures of wanting to wear more fashionable clothing, as many teenagers do. Wanting to make more expensive purchases based more around looks than application, Donna had a great idea. Brandy could get a job as a waitress so that she'd be able to put some money in her pocket and pick up all the fashion choices that her heart desired. While Brandy was happy with the idea, there was one issue which Brandy feared. Her shyness at the time was so extreme that she was afraid to approach customers, spending as much time as she could in the kitchen, helping out. Brandy ended up working at a restaurant called Pappy's, located in the town of Hanahan. She will end up working there, off and on, for the next few years. While it was gradual, Brandy slowly began to open up. Her constant exposure to new people, situations, and knowing that the more she opened up and related to customers, the better her tips would be, drove the young woman to try harder. It worked, and soon Brandy found herself showing more color and personality. The more Brandy revealed of herself, the more customers found her difficult to turn away from. Much like when she had been a little girl, Brandy once again wielded that magic personality and charisma which drew others to her. Brandy became so popular amongst customers that many came purely to be served by her, and it wasn't uncommon for diners to request her by name. With a world full of options in front of her, Brandy would ultimately make the choice that she wanted to follow Donna into the restaurant business and to be a waitress. She enjoyed the environment, the people, the never-ending stream of customers, and most specifically, working with her friends and later, her mother. When Brandy was in her mid-20s, she'd fall in love with a man, Michael Ray McAdams Jr., known to most simply as Ray. Their relationship would develop rapidly, and for Brandy, it would be the very thing she had been looking for. McAdam's sister-in-law, Amy, would ultimately become Brandy's best friend, and so the environment gave them nearly everything she wanted. There was no denying from those around her that Brandy was happy in her relationship. After the courtship, Brandy would move in with Ray and take up a waitressing job at a location close to her new home. For a time, everything seemed to be going well, although Donna had some doubts about the relationship. She couldn't quite put her finger on it, but there was some aspect of Brandy's relationship with Ray that, for lack of a better term, made her uncomfortable. Despite this, Brandy and Ray continued on their way, and eventually, Ray proposed and Brandy accepted. She was happily engaged and looking forward to starting a life with her soon-to-be husband. Everything seemed to be falling into place, but it would be the combination of a divorce, a close friend, and a desire to help that would ultimately turn Brandy and Ray's world upside down. Brandy and Ray had gotten together in late 1999, and their relationship had run nearly 6 years before it would come to an end in a heartbreaking fashion. Ray worked for a local plumbing and construction company run by the father of his close friend, Garland Lankford, known to most by the name Zeke. In 2004, Zeke's own marriage began running into trouble and he got separated. Having fallen on hard times and having nowhere to turn, Ray reached out to his friend and offered him a place to stay. The idea was to provide Zeke with a bed, warm meals, and a place to feel welcome until he could get back on his feet. This decision would prove to be pivotal, as despite the complicated nature of the situation, there was a spark of attraction between Brandy and Zeke. Though both attempted to suppress their feelings early on, those emotions would grow, and soon the two would find themselves in a situation which neither could deny. It wasn't what either of them had wanted, and while Brandy didn't want to hurt Ray, she couldn't pretend she wasn't falling for Zeke. In March of 2005, now 32 years old, Brandy decided to take a new waitressing job. With her mother having been at Alex's restaurant for more than 30 years and now working as a manager, Brandy got hired on there. Both women were excited by the proposition. Now working in the same place, they'd certainly see each other more. Just 1 month later, in April, Ray discovered the truth, and he reacted as you'd expect most people would. Though I should note, there have been some reports that it was actually Brandy who confessed to Ray rather than him uncovering the truth about her and Zeke. Either way, Ray told Zeke to get out of his house and not return. And while he was hurt and upset by Brandy, he still loved her and couldn't just turn that off. Ray offered Brandy the option to continue living there, to work on their relationship, and to move forward with their engagement. The two seemed to have been in a different headspace, and Ray imagined it was merely a temporary attraction based on living together, but for Brandy, it was something more. Brandy's friend Robin would later describe it by saying that Brandy was, quote, head over heels for Zeke, end quote. When faced with the option of staying in their home, maintaining her lifestyle and staying with Ray, or leaving to face the unknown where her and Zeke would go, Brandy chose to leave. According to friends and family, Ray didn't give up and tried to convince Brandy that Zeke wasn't right for her and it wouldn't work out, but Brandy was unwavering in her decision. Once she made her mind up, it wasn't easy to get her to change it, especially when it came to matters of the heart. Ultimately, Brandy left behind a comfortable home and many of her belongings to strike out into the world with Zeke, and it would certainly be challenging, to say the least. Looking for an apartment, preferably one with a close proximity to Alex's restaurant, since Brandy didn't have a car, was not an easy task. Most of the apartments in nicer areas were simply outside of their price range, what with Brandy working as a waitress, and Zeke working off and on for his father, though more often off than on, that didn't make things easier. The couple did manage to find a very nice apartment in a neighborhood known as Chicora Cherokee, one which had somewhat of a bad reputation. This was troubling to Donna, who later stated, quote, it was rough, things were boarded up. You just don't want your young daughter living in a neighborhood that's known for crime and drugs. End quote. Donna tried to convince Brandy to look elsewhere, but Zeke was pushing hard for this particular location. The apartment itself was quite nice, and the building was located just 1.3 miles away from Alex's restaurant, over on Florida Avenue. Despite Donna's requests, Brandy and Zeke decided to move in. While initially, Donna believed everything was all right, and by most accounts, Brandy seemed happy, there was an incident which raised Donna's suspicions. Prior to moving into the apartment, she was approached by the couple for a loan so that they could cover the security deposit, which was necessary before signing their lease, which would ultimately be month to month. Donna was a bit annoyed, feeling that while she tried so hard to convince Brandy to look elsewhere, Zeke had been working against her, and now she was going to loan her daughter money to move into an apartment that she didn't want her living in the first place. Once the lease was signed, Brandy and Zeke moved in. While the situation may not have been ideal, Brandy was excited. Her brother Shane would later say, quote, "She seemed happier. She seemed like this was what she wanted." End quote. Things began well. Brandy was working at Alex's, coming home to Zeke, and together they were planning to build a relationship. The situation was somewhat complicated by the fact that Zeke wasn't officially divorced yet and was obviously dealing with the emotions of going through a separation, while Brandy continued to receive calls and visits from Ray, who was trying to talk her out of this decision. Several times, Ray came by Alex's to talk to Brandy. On one particular occasion, Ray made a bizarre statement to Donna that unnerved her and would later come back to haunt her. Donna explained, quote, "They were sitting in the restaurant one time, and just out of the blue, he said, 'I could kill your daughter and get away with it.' I was like, 'What are you talking about?' And that's when he was like, 'I could take her and make her disappear, and you'd never know.'" End quote. At the time, Donna didn't know what to make of this, but wrote it off as Ray trying to sound tough or in control. Many friends have said that there was a weird tension between Donna and Ray, as though Ray tried to exercise his dominance over Brandy when she was around her mother. Suddenly, and without warning, Brandy's life was once again impacted by an unexpected change. Within weeks of moving in together, Zeke explained that he was going back to his wife and children. Nearly as quickly as he'd made this announcement, he packed up all of his belongings and left, leaving Brandy alone in the apartment they'd leased together. By all accounts, Brandy was devastated. She was in love with Zeke, and it broke her heart to know that he was going back to his wife, but by the same token, she wasn't going to try and stop him. While Brandy desperately wanted to build a life with Zeke and had fallen hard for him, she had no interest in breaking up a marriage if that was what Zeke really wanted. Discussing this situation, Donna later explained, quote, "She didn't like the fact that she felt like he wanted her to wait for him, but she wasn't going to play the other woman. As much as she cared about him, that's just not what she wanted." End quote. Faced with needing to decide what to do, Brandy made the choice to stay in the apartment on her own. She'd been involved in a 6-year relationship with Ray, had experienced heartbreak with Zeke, and now it was time for her to settle down, collect her thoughts, and figure out what she wanted to do. It was a difficult time for Brandy, but she was focused on moving forward. Whatever had happened in the past wasn't going to change, and she had no choice but to continue on. At the same time, there was a glimmer of hope. According to her friend and co-worker, Robin, Brandy believed it was possible that Zeke would come back. She considered it likely that he'd simply gotten cold feet and in a moment of weakness, chosen to return home. There was a part of her that believed he'd come back, but at the same time, she didn't want to just wait around. With the news of the breakup making the rounds, it wasn't long before Ray began trying harder to win Brandy back. It was around this time that Brandy began to open up a little bit about her previous relationship with Ray, and according to Robin, she would confess that she was afraid of her former boyfriend and fiancé. The specifics of this statement have never been revealed, if indeed Brandy went any further than simply making that statement, but it wasn't much of a surprise. Whenever Ray had been around, most people could feel something in the air. Whether it was a controlling nature, a bizarre sense of humor, or an intimidating presence, there were a few friends of Brandy's who felt comfortable around Ray, even if they could never quite put their finger on why. On Thursday, May 19th, 2005, Brandy made plans to meet with her close friend and Ray's sister-in-law, Amy McAdams, at her former job, Pappy's Restaurant. While Brandy had since moved on to Alex's, Amy was still waitressing at the old job. The two women chatted, caught up, and laughed together. Their friendship had always been strong, despite the relationship complications, and Amy adored Brandy. While talking, Brandy explained that she was going to be taking the weekend off and wanted to go to the beach. She needed some time to just relax and clear her mind. One of the other waitresses, named Susan, came around and Brandy invited her along on the trip, but Susan was working and wouldn't be able to go. While there, Brandy asked Amy if she would be able to take her shopping the next evening. She wanted to get a new bathing suit for her weekend trip, and Amy agreed. This will be the last time Amy and Brandy ever see one another. On Friday, May 20th, Brandy was scheduled to work the opening shift at Alex's from 7 a.m. to 2:30 p.m., at which time her mother would be coming in to relieve her. According to coworkers, Brandy was her normal, bubbly self that day and actually seemed to be in higher spirits than usual. She'd heard from Zeke recently, and he wanted to see her, wanted to talk. While she didn't want to get her hopes up, she couldn't help but wonder if he might be ready to finally commit to her. At one point during her shift, Brandy received a phone call, and this seemed to change her entire demeanor. A regular customer, Thomas Johnson, was sitting a few tables away and saw Brandy's reaction to the call. Later, while serving him, Johnson asked if she was all right, and Brandy made a cryptic comment that someone had scared her, but she didn't give any more information. When Robin saw Brandy, she could tell something was wrong. When she asked, Brandy explained that the call had had something to do with Zeke's wife, Diana. Robin later stated, quote, "I don't know if the call was actually Diana calling her or somebody calling Brandy telling her that Diana had a problem with her," end quote. While the call definitely appeared to have shaken Brandy, it wasn't long before she got back to her normal self. Throughout the course of the day, Brandy was walking around with two cell phones in her pocket. Due to her financial strains at having to now swing the apartment rent on her own, she'd been using a prepaid cell phone. However, Donna liked talking to Brandy often and was concerned that she could run out of minutes, so days earlier, she had purchased a cell phone and given it to her daughter. The new phone was on a contract and didn't require the purchasing of prepaid cards. Brandy was excited at the gift, but hadn't yet mastered her new phone. Toward the end of her Friday shift, she placed a call to Donna asking what time she'd be arriving at work. Brandy explained that she needed help setting up the voicemail on the new phone. Donna arrived at Alex's between 2:30 and 3 p.m. and immediately started chatting with Brandy. The two laughed and caught up. Brandy handed her phone over to her mother, who was teasing her about not being able to set up her own voicemail. As a joke, Donna recorded the outgoing message saying that she was Brandy's mommy and to leave a message if you wanted to talk to her. Both women laughed about it, and Brandy ended up leaving that as her outgoing message, thinking it was cute and funny. Shortly before 3 p.m., Brandy filled a to-go cup with iced tea, said goodbye to her mother, and walked out the door to the waiting car of Andy Ragnow, a former police officer who now made extra money on the side by giving people rides. Making the short drive to Brandy's apartment, Ragnar later describes her demeanor as happy-go-lucky. When exiting the vehicle, Brandy looked back and told him she'd see him Monday. He sat in the parking lot, watching until the young woman had entered her apartment before driving off. According to friends and family, Brandy wasn't much of a partier. She didn't enjoy drinking and never went to clubs or bars. After being on her feet all day, she'd usually get home, curl up under a blanket on the couch, watch TV, text, make calls, and eventually just fall asleep in the glow of the television. She had a small, tight-knit circle of friends that she would hang out with, but she was very much a homebody. This evening began no different, with records showing that Brandy sent texts and made calls from both her new phone and her old phone. Donna spoke to Brandy several times, with the last call taking place at 5:30 p.m. Brandy explained that she'd exchanged texts with Zeke, and he was going to try and come by to see her that night. She told Donna she'd call later, but this will actually be the last time Donna will ever speak to her daughter. Later on, at approximately 8 p.m., Brandy texted with Amy McAdams. She wanted to solidify their plans for the evening to go shopping for a bathing suit. Amy explained that her shift was going to run long and she'd be later than expected, but that she'd definitely come by to pick her up that night. According to Donna, while she was working that night and the dinner rush was coming to a close, she found herself standing at a window in the restaurant, looking in the direction of Brandy's apartment. She couldn't explain why, but she suddenly had an overwhelming feeling that something wasn't right. Following up on this feeling, she picked up the phone and called Brandy, but was answered only by the voicemail. She left a message, but after not hearing back, she'd call several more times. It was highly unlike Brandy to not answer her phone. She was on the phone constantly, and this didn't help Donna's uneasy feeling. She wasn't sure if something was wrong or if perhaps Brandy had fallen asleep. She'd leave several more messages on Brandy's voicemail that evening. Interestingly, while Brandy isn't answering Donna's calls, nor calling her back, she is still active on her phone, or at least, someone is. Her voicemail got checked at approximately 9 p.m., and a text was sent to Zeke's phone at 10 p.m. Amy finally got off her shift at Pappy's and made the drive over to Brandy's apartment, arriving around 10:30 p.m. She approached the door and began knocking. After not receiving an answer, she looked in the windows and saw that, other than the light from the television, the apartment was dark and there was no movement inside. Wondering if Brandy had fallen asleep, Amy called her old prepaid cell phone. She could hear it faintly ringing inside the apartment, but there was no answer. Ultimately, Amy assumed that Brandy was simply sleeping, and after several minutes of knocking and calling, she got back in her car and drove home, figuring they'd talk the next day. The next morning, Saturday, May 21st, Donna placed several more calls to Brandy, but didn't receive an answer. Growing concerned, she stopped by the apartment after her shift at work. Much like Amy, Donna found the apartment dark and no response when she knocked. Donna stood outside the door and placed a call, but did not hear any ringing in the apartment. At this point, she assumed Brandy had gone to the beach as planned and is likely just busy doing something. When she spoke to Robin later and explained the lack of answers, Robin suggested it's possible that she was just upset about Zeke and wanted some time to herself. Later that same day, Amy tried to call Brandy to find out what had happened to her the night before, but again, received no answer. Amy later explained, quote, "I didn't think anything of it. I figured she was at the beach," end quote. It's now been more than 24 hours since the last confirmed sighting of Brandy. Sunday, May 22nd, will come and go with no contact from Brandy again, passing more than 48 hours since she was last seen. On Sundays, Brandy typically meets up with her family and they all have breakfast together. While it's strange that she doesn't arrive for the breakfast, many of them are still under the impression that she's at the beach, and so it isn't exactly unexpected. This same day, Donna speaks to her co-workers at the restaurant and explains the situation. While she's concerned about Brandy, she still isn't completely panicked, assuming her daughter is just at the beach, having a good time. Brandy was scheduled to work at 7 a.m. the next day, and so, for her own peace of mind, Donna requested that the restaurant call her if Brandy didn't show up for her shift. On Monday, the 23rd, 7 a.m. came and went. Donna felt relieved knowing that Brandy must have shown up for her shift since no one had called her. Unfortunately, this feeling of comfort was quickly obliterated when her phone rang at approximately 7:20. An employee from the restaurant explained that Brandy hadn't shown up for her shift, and to her co-workers, this is the first major sign that something is wrong. Brandy loves her job and is incredibly dedicated to it. She would never fail to show up without telling someone ahead of time unless something was seriously wrong. Finally feeling that Brandy must be in trouble, Donna called the North Charleston Police Department to file a missing persons report, but she was met with indifference. According to the police, Brandy was an adult and had the right to go off without telling anyone if she wanted to. They would later explain that if they dedicated an investigation to every adult who goes off without telling anyone, they'd never have time to investigate other crimes. While Donna insists something is wrong, authorities at this time view her simply as a mother who is having difficulty getting in contact with her daughter. Desperate for answers, Donna picked up her phone and called Zeke. She explained the situation to him, and knowing that he still had a key to the apartment, requested that he meet her there and let her in. Zeke was out on a plumbing job, but he agreed to meet Donna after. Donna specifically requested that Zeke not enter the apartment without her, and he agreed. But when she arrived in the parking lot, she saw Zeke come walking out of the apartment. Frustrated and angry, Donna demanded to know why he went in when she had specifically asked him not to, and according to her, Zeke responded, quote, "Well, I was worried you were going to find something, and I didn't want you to walk in and see her body," end quote. This statement caught Donna completely off guard, and she didn't understand why Zeke would say something like that. Frustrated and confused by Zeke's actions, Donna entered the apartment and was surprised by what she saw. Everything was in perfect order. There was no mess, no sign of a struggle or forced entry. The to-go cup of tea that Brandy had taken with her on Friday was still there. There was a blanket on the couch, suggesting that Brandy had been lying there, as she usually did. In her bedroom, her prepaid phone was on the nightstand and plugged into its charger, though the phone Donna bought her was nowhere to be found. Besides the phone, the only other item missing were the keys to the apartment. It appeared as though Brandy had left the apartment of her own free will, with the intention of coming back, but had never made it. Without answers, without any clues as to where Brandy may have gone, Donna's concern was growing exponentially, and for the next 4 days, she will place calls to Brandy and the police. It won't be until Friday, May 27th, 1 week after Brandy was last seen, that the North Charleston Police Department will agree to investigate. Precious days have been lost, and in missing persons cases, those early hours and days are the most important. A detective assigned to the case met with Donna, who explained the situation and provided him with a key to the apartment. Donna requested that the officer do whatever was necessary to figure out what was going on, and he left to examine the scene. But to Donna's shock and surprise, he returned less than an hour later. When asked what was going on, the detective explained that he'd entered the apartment, found nothing to be out of order, no indication that a crime was committed, and that he didn't see any signs that anything was wrong. Frustrated with the lack of urgency and the detective's seemingly carefree attitude about her daughter's disappearance, Donna began enlisting friends and family members to help search for Brandy. Knowing that Brandy lived in a predominantly African-American neighborhood, the family assumed that the blue-eyed, blonde-haired young woman would stick out. They began going door-to-door asking if anyone had seen her. Many people replied that they'd seen Brandy in the past, walking to or from work, but that they hadn't seen her recently. Missing persons flyers were printed up bearing Brandy's image, description, and last known location. Together, friends and family plastered the neighborhood with the flyers, hoping that someone would come forward with information. Brandy does, though, have some connections to law enforcement. Her uncle, Henry Smalley Jr., is on the North Charleston Police Department and actually heads up their boat unit. He knows Brandy's neighborhood well and has a lot of contacts there. Lieutenant Rick Keyes, a family friend, is not assigned to the case but also chips in to assist. Smalley is concerned about an area located not too far from Brandy's neighborhood. There's an old abandoned naval base. It sprawls out, covering a large area with a lot of rooms, some locked and others unlocked. The building has been trashed by teenagers and criminals alike, who often use the location as a spot from which to conduct illegal activities. Smalley's concerned because it's known to be a place where a body may be concealed and unlikely to be found. Together, with friends and family, Smalley goes over as much of the base as he can. Brandy's aunt, Yvonne, later explained, quote, "If any building was abandoned, we were in it. If it was unlocked, we were in it. We searched every room that we found open." End quote. Unfortunately, the complex is rather large, and despite their efforts, they don't manage to locate anything which suggests that Brandy had been there. While canvassing the area around Brandy's apartment, Lieutenant Keyes begins speaking to a neighbor, asking if she'd seen Brandy lately. Chevetta Johnson tells Keyes that not only had she seen Brandy, but she'd seen her on the night she disappeared. According to Johnson, sometime between 9 and 9:30 p.m. on Friday, a truck had pulled into the parking lot and Brandy had exited her apartment, gotten into the passenger seat, and appeared to be talking with the driver. Johnson never saw the truck leave and didn't watch for too long, but she got a good look at both the truck and the driver. According to Johnson, the driver was a white male with scraggly hair and a beard. The truck he drove was red, with a white stripe running down the side, and one particular detail which made it unique. Adhered to the front grille was a Jason Voorhees-style hockey mask, like from the Friday the 13th movies. This description matches two men in Brandy's life, Ray McAdams and Zeke Lankford. Both men are Caucasians, have scraggly hair and beards, and drive red trucks. In fact, Zeke's father's plumbing business uses red trucks with a white stripe down the side. The hockey mask, however, is specific to only one of the men's vehicles, Ray McAdams. Hoping to get Johnson to identify a suspect, Keyes asks her to accompany him. He's planning to drive over to one of the suspect's homes, during which time he's going to leave Johnson in the car. He puts a Bluetooth earpiece in and gets on the phone with Johnson. He explains that he's going to knock on the door, and when the man comes out, Johnson is to tell him whether or not this is the man she saw that night. Johnson agreed, and together they drove over to the residence of Ray McAdams. According to Keyes, as soon as Ray appeared at the door, Johnson exclaimed that it was the same man she saw driving the truck that night. He later said, quote, "She is not just telling me it's him. She's yelling in my ear to the point that I'm afraid he's going to hear it. That was a witness that I've never seen so excited to say, I'm not 98% sure, I'm 100% sure it's him." End quote. At this point in time, investigators working the case were beginning to narrow their field. In their minds, there were only two men who they believed might be involved, Ray McAdams and Zeke Lankford. Both men were approached and questioned about their whereabouts on the night of Friday, May 20th, but both were able to provide alibis. According to Ray, he had left his home sometime around 8 p.m. on Friday night and went to a club, the Plex, at which he had applied to be a bouncer. He claimed to have not left the club until after 1 a.m., and a friend confirmed that was true. As for Zeke, he claimed that he had made plans to see Brandy that night, but had gotten stuck working late, and his brother-in-law confirmed his alibi. When questioned about Brandy's disappearance, each man implicates the other as likely having been involved. Zeke allegedly said, quote, "I know she'd had some problems with her ex-boyfriend. I fear the absolute worst." End quote. For investigators, they'd reached a stalemate. Authorities began tailing the two men and digging into their lives. After a week, Ray spoke with investigators and agreed to come down to the station and take a polygraph test. He arrived, sat through the test, and answered every question. According to detectives, he passed his test. Zeke was also asked to take the test, and while he agreed, he delayed, not taking it for nearly 2 months. When he finally did take the test, he was described as acting nervous and behaving oddly, though he did ultimately pass. Once again, investigators find themselves back to square one. They have two men who they believe could have been involved, but no evidence to connect either of them to Brandy that night. Even Johnson's identification of Ray can't do much for them other than increase their focus on McAdams. On May 30th, 10 days after Brandy disappeared, the media was flooded with coverage about a missing young woman, blonde-haired and blue-eyed. Her story swept the nation, and there were countless articles written, hours of television spent, and websites constructed digging into her bizarre disappearance. Unfortunately for Donna, it was not the story of Brandy Hannah that was getting all the attention, but that of an 18-year-old Natalie Holloway who vanished in Aruba on a senior class trip. For Donna, it was absolutely heartbreaking. She eventually was pushed to the point of anger when a local newspaper, the Post and Courier, wrote an article about the Mississippi native but hadn't put out a single word about South Carolina's own Brandy Hannah. When asked about this, Donna responded, quote, "There was a lot of coverage for Natalie Holloway, and I couldn't understand because there was very little for Brandy, and as her mother, you question it. Not that I was begrudging her, but you question, why not my child?" End quote. Donna wrote to the Post and Courier, who responded by writing the first of several articles about Brandy's disappearance. After so many days of being disregarded, the police were working the case and seemed to be taking it seriously, and now the media was finally weighing in. In a turn of events which may have had a devastating impact on the future of the case, Donna was contacted by Brandy's landlord. She had only paid up on her lease until the end of the month, and so he told Donna that she could either come and remove Brandy's items from the apartment, or he would place them out on the street. Since the apartment had not been designated as a crime scene, there was little Donna could do. Not long after Brandy had vanished, Donna and her sister Yvonne were inside the apartment, boxing up all of her belongings. It's during this time that they discover a small can filled with cash from Brandy's tips and paychecks. They also note none of Brandy's clothing is missing, and a photograph she has of herself as a baby in Donna's arms is still in the apartment. According to Donna, Brandy never lived anywhere without that photo. For them, this completely eliminates any possibility that Brandy could have run off. Unfortunately, any evidence of forensic value which may have existed in the apartment is lost when it is cleaned out and rented to a new tenant. While the case was now getting some attention, little was coming out of it. Tips were called in but failed to lead anywhere, and while law enforcement officers reached out to local informants in the area, all reported that there was news about Brandy being missing, but not a single person seemed to have a clue as to what happened to her. The case was quickly growing cold, and with no evidence and no leads, authorities didn't have much to work with. In hopes of drumming up some new information, the Community United Effort, or Q Center for Missing Persons, got involved. In August, some 3 months after Brandy vanished, they would have their first official search. Utilizing tracking dogs and items containing Brandy's scent, searchers hoped to get a better idea of where Brandy may have gone that night. The North Charleston Police Department also participated in the search, along with countless volunteers made of friends, family, and North Charleston locals. One face, though, stuck out from the crowd. Zeke Lankford was there, watching the comings and goings of searchers and police. According to Donna, one of the individuals present that night was her niece, and Zeke approached her and began asking questions. Allegedly, Zeke asked if tracking dogs would be able to locate Brandy if she was buried. Disturbed by this question, investigators approached Zeke at the conclusion of the search and requested that he not show up for the next one and to steer clear of Brandy's family. Around this same time, the missing persons flyers that had been made up were used to create a giant banner that was hung on the outside of Alex's restaurant. The banner was big enough that vehicles passing on the interstate nearby would see it, and they had hoped it would bring in more tips, since the search had yielded no results. More than 7 months would pass before there was any news or developments on the case. In April of 2006, 11 months after Brandy disappeared, Donna received an upsetting phone call. It was Ray McAdams' mother calling to inform her that Ray had passed away as the result of a heart attack that morning. If indeed he knew anything about Brandy's disappearance, he had taken that information with him to the grave. Donna, over the last year, had oscillated between believing Ray may have been involved to wondering if perhaps he was innocent. She believed that Ray loved her daughter. He was very cooperative with authorities, had participated in searches, vigils, and attempts to drum up media attention. However, there were pieces of his story that didn't make sense. Brandy's friend and Ray's sister-in-law, Amy, later told authorities that, on the night Brandy vanished, she had dropped some items off to Ray. Allegedly, these items were given to him around 9:30 p.m., in the middle of the time he claimed to have been at the club applying to be a bouncer. With holes now in his alibi, but no way to follow up, investigators found themselves once again hitting a brick wall. Tragically, just 2 weeks after McAdams' death, Brandy's uncle Henry Smalley Jr. passed away after a difficult battle with cancer. He had worked hard to try and find his niece, and had given so much of himself to try and find the answers. Amongst some of his final words, he promised Donna that when he got to heaven, he'd find Brandy and somehow find a way to communicate back to her what had happened. Over the next few years, more tips will come in, but none that lead anywhere. A man posing as an undercover police officer will approach Donna and ultimately get arrested for impersonating an officer. At his trial, it will seem apparent that the man suffers from mental health issues, and while disturbing, it's considered highly unlikely that he possessed any knowledge of Brandy's whereabouts. Each year, on her birthday, Brandy's family hold a celebration and candlelight vigil at Alex's restaurant, with her beautiful face smiling down at them from the giant missing persons poster. On November 16, 2010, more than 5 years after she had last seen her daughter, Donna spoke with some members of the media, saying, quote, "You learn to take each day one step at a time, or else I would have fallen apart. I have to keep going, be strong, because I have to keep looking for her. It's very important because I try to keep in people's minds she is missing. She has been missing, but she has not been forgotten. I just want answers. More than anything, to know where she is, to know what happened." End quote. During this time, Donna's desperation for answers becomes overwhelming. She will ultimately contact a psychic located in West Virginia. Then, in February of 2011, Donna is approached by Sergeant Ron Locker of the North Charleston Police Department. Having driven by Alex's a number of times and seen the missing persons banner, something compelled him to go inside and ask about it. While speaking with Donna about the case, he explained that he did not usually work missing persons cases, but with her permission, he would like to reopen the investigation. Donna felt overwhelmed with gratitude and told Locker she'd do anything she could to help. Over the years, the case had passed through the hands of multiple investigators. All of the files had been stored away, leads tracked down, false sightings corrected. It was Locker's intention to start from the beginning, and his first move was to re-interview everyone he could find who had been spoken to during the initial weeks of the investigation. He also began looking at all of the evidence available and was upset when he realized how many potential leads were not followed up on. The phone call that Brandy had received at work the day she vanished hadn't been tracked. While Locker tried to get his hands on the phone records, 6 years had passed, and they were no longer available. He believed that figuring out who called that day may have led to a potential suspect, or at least shown some light on the mystery. Next, Locker discovered that, in the weeks and months following Brandy's disappearance, despite a witness describing the truck she got into that night, no forensic testing had been conducted on Ray McAdams' truck, nor the trucks owned by Zeke's father's business. In a bizarre turn of events, after Ray's death, his truck seems to have vanished. No one knew where to find it, and Locker, therefore, was unable to conduct testing on it in the aftermath. His next idea was to speak to Chevetta Johnson, the witness who had identified Ray as the man driving the truck that night. This time, Locker asked Johnson to tell her story again, and considering 6 years had gone by, her story remained remarkably consistent. However, when he showed her a photo array containing six faces, including those of Ray McAdams and Zeke Lankford, she positively identified Zeke. Previously, she had suggested that Ray had been the man she'd seen, but Locker doesn't know what to depend on. It had been dark the night she'd seen the man, and both Zeke and Ray bore a striking resemblance to one another. Beyond that, Lieutenant Keyes had driven Chiavetta straight to Ray, which may have influenced her previous identification. Knowing that he couldn't question Ray, and that Zeke had been evasive in the years since, Locker changed his approach. Rather than trying to figure out who may have been involved, he decided to focus in specifically on what may have happened to Brandy and where she might be. At this point in time, Locker believes Brandy was the victim of a homicide, and so he started scouting out areas near her former apartment, which may have been used to conceal her body. Ultimately, he found himself in not only an area that Donna's psychic had suggested, but also one which the family had been to as early as just days after Brandy disappeared, the old abandoned naval base. The area had changed in the past 6 years. In 2005, a waterfront park was being developed, and so the area had a lot of overturned land and piles of rocks and dirt, which would have provided easy access to storing a body, which would ultimately be covered up. There was a newly established industrial section, and what had once been a golf course had been overgrown with weeds and swallowed partially by salt marshes and had become a hunting ground for alligators. While researching the area, Locker discovers that, back in 2005, the golf course had been completely above the water and had dirt roads designed for golf carts to drive through the area, but these roads were also wide enough for larger vehicles, like a truck. Desperate for answers, Locker begins visiting this area in his free time, explaining, quote, "I would throw on a bunch of old clothes, go down with the shovel, and start digging just in random areas," end quote. One evening, while he was down there, Locker's attention was drawn to a concrete wall under what was once a pier. Without knowing why, he approached the area, waiting for low tide, during which time he could access the sand and mud beneath the pier. Digging near the cement wall, one of his shovel strokes hit something beneath the ground, and as he pulled the dirty blade from the earth, along with it came a circular ring, a seal, used to close 55-gallon drums. In addition to the ring, there was something else, a shoe. Specifically, a woman's blue and white Nike cross trainer size 10.5. On the last day she was seen, Brandy was described as wearing a pair of blue and white Nike cross trainers that she'd recently purchased. Brandy wore a size 10, but with cross trainers, it isn't uncommon for people to purchase them half a size to a full size larger. Upon further inspection, Locker discovers the manufactured date on the inside of the tongue of the shoe, January 25th, 2005, just 4 months before Brandy vanished. Locker bagged the shoe and sent it out for DNA analysis, and at the same time, the North Charleston police reached out to the state's archaeologist. The archaeologist agreed to bring his team down to the area for a dig, looking for bone fragments, clothing, whatever they might be able to find. Unfortunately, the dig will last for a total of 3 days, but yield no further results. The DNA analysis will return inconclusive, as no human DNA is found on the shoe, but for Locker, it's too much of a coincidence. When asked about whether or not the shoe belonged to Brandy, he replied, quote, "What are the odds of the same size, same color, same make, the date code, and in an area that's so remote that I believe a body was disposed of? So in my mind, I believe it's hers," end quote. Locker believes it's entirely possible that Brandy's body may have been buried in the golf course, and that over the years, as the salt marsh swallowed it, she may have drifted into the Cooper River, at which point the currents would have carried her out and around. Whether or not her remains continued on while her shoe drifted to the spot he found it, he can't say for certain, but it's his belief that the remains of Brandy Hanna are somewhere in that area, and he's determined to find her. For Locker, it's a difficult case. No real evidence exists. There are no major clues, and when it comes down to potential suspects, it's all a matter of opinions and hearsay, nothing solid to work with. That, however, will change in the coming years, as will many other things. Alex's restaurant officially closed in 2012, yet another place connected to Brandy that will be lost to time. In 2013, Brandy was declared legally dead. Then, 3 years later, another break in the case. In December of 2016, 11 and a half years after Brandy vanished, North Charleston police arrested Garland Zeke Lankford. Lankford was serving time in a Berkeley County jail related to first-degree criminal sexual misconduct. He had allegedly sexually assaulted a minor on at least two occasions between 2012 and 2013. Being that he was sitting in jail, this gave investigators access to speak with him about Brandy's case. Much of Locker's interest in speaking to Lankford came from a tipster who claimed to have known Lankford and two other individuals who may have had ties to Brandy's disappearance. During several interviews between Locker and Lankford, several discrepancies were discovered in his initial statements to investigators from 2005. Lankford's alibi had revolved around the fact that he'd claimed to have been working late that night, but records from his father's business indicated that he'd clocked out at 4 p.m. that Friday. Lankford had told investigators that, around the time Brandy disappeared, Ray McAdams had contacted him multiple times about her case, but phone records showed that it had actually been Lankford who'd contacted McAdams. When confronted with this information, Lankford admitted that he actually did see Brandy the night she vanished. Phone records also implicated Lankford in having called in false tips to investigators, trying to point the finger at someone else as a possible suspect, and when asked about this, Lankford admitted he had made those calls. Having gathered this evidence and shown that Lankford had lied to investigators, Zeke requested a lawyer and was ultimately charged with obstruction of justice. Rather than face the potential of a 10-year prison sentence, the maximum he could have been given if found guilty, Lankford pled guilty and was sentenced to 2 years in prison, with 2 years probation to follow. In a strange turn of events, Ray McAdams' father, Michael, contacted Sergeant Locker about the case and explained that he'd heard a story that Zeke had gotten in over his head with some drug dealers and that he'd abducted Brandy and used her as collateral to pay off the debt, at which point she was sent away. Locker later explained, quote, "Whether or not it was true, I don't know, but I was told she was sent to Houston to pay off that debt," end quote. The most recent developments in the case seem to indicate that Locker believes not only was Zeke involved in Brandy's disappearance, but that he may have had the help of two other individuals. In an interview with the media, Locker stated, quote, "Mr. Lankford was in fact involved. Everything points to him," end quote. When asked for further information, Locker explained that they were interested in speaking to two locals who they believe were involved, and that while they couldn't go into details about it, they did have other evidence which pointed them in that direction. At this point, it's a matter of time, and hoping that someone else with information will come forward and finally put an end to the pain and heartbreak Brandy's family and friends have suffered for nearly 14 years. Unlike many cases examined on this show, the disappearance of Brandy Hanna has a very specific set of theories revolving around it. There is no belief that Brandy left of her own volition, that she was abducted by a stranger or became the victim of a random act of violence. All of the theories in Brandy's case, thanks to the diligence and hard work of Sergeant Locker, Donna Parent, and others, leads only to two specific possibilities. The first theory suggests that Ray McAdams may have been involved in Brandy's disappearance, either on his own or possibly in conjunction with Zeke Lankford. For many, there are too many details which point at both men for it to have simply been just one. The second and final theory suggests that Zeke Lankford, in association with two other people, went to Brandy Hanna's apartment that night under the guise of talking about their relationship, but ultimately, things took a bitter turn, and Brandy was murdered and disposed of somewhere near the Cooper River in North Charleston. It's unknown whether this was an act of premeditated murder, or if it was the result of an accident or by some other method, But for this particular theory, it is argued that Lankford caused Brandy's death and then concealed her body while trying to obstruct the investigation and point all suspicions on Ray McAdams. Others believe Lankford may have in fact trafficked Brandy in order to pay off a drug debt. When last seen, Brandy Renee Hanna was described as being a Caucasian female with blonde hair and blue eyes, standing 5 feet 9 inches tall and weighing approximately 115 pounds. She was last seen wearing a light blue shirt, jeans, and blue and white Nike shoes. She also wore a diamond ring with small diamonds arranged in a flower shape. Brandy's upper teeth are crooked, and there is also a gap between her front teeth. Her left ear is pierced 3 times, and her right is pierced twice. She has a tattoo of a heart between her right thumb and forefinger, and a tattoo of a sun on her right shoulder. Her blood type is listed as A positive. She was last seen in a 3,000 block of Florida Avenue in North Charleston, South Carolina, on Friday, May 20th, 2005. The disappearance of Brandy Hanna is a difficult case to examine. So much of the early investigation is flawed, what little evidence exists is hard to depend on, and when it comes down to suspects, while there is certainly a great deal of suspicion, there isn't much concrete to connect anyone directly to Brandy that night. Yes, Lankford has been found guilty of obstruction, but it's a long march from obstruction to homicide. For Donna Parent, it doesn't get any easier wondering what became of her beloved daughter. All of these years later, she is grateful for the hard work and assistance of Sergeant Locker, and she believes that Brandy was murdered. It is her hope that someday all of the truth will come out, and that whoever was responsible will pay the price, and she might have her daughter returned to her, to be able to lay her to rest, to be able to have a place to visit and mourn, to be able to say goodbye without wondering where the truth lies. Progress on this case makes her hopeful, and given the events of the past few years, investigators believe they're going to crack this case. They just need someone to offer them a helping hand. This year, CrimeCon will be held in New Orleans from June 7th through the 9th. Amidst exciting presentations and inspiring discussions, I'm really looking forward to attending and representing Trace Evidence on Podcast Row. If you're planning to attend but haven't yet purchased your pass, you can save 10% by using the promo code TRACE19. Simply visit crimecon.com, select a standard pass, and use the code TRACE19. That's TRACE19 to save 10% today. I look forward to seeing you there. The disappearance of Brandy Hanna is a case unlike many that I've covered in the past. Usually there's a great deal of speculation, rumor, whispers, and theories, but in this case there's really only two, and investigators seem to be in possession of everything they could possibly need, except for that one piece of evidence that would be strong enough to get an arrest warrant. We have two suspects, Ray McAdams and Zeke Lankford, both men who had relationships with Brandy, both men who seemed to not want to fully let her go, both men who would lie to investigators during the initial stages of their search for Brandy, and both men who had once been close friends, before Zeke and Brandy fell for one another. Looking at the theories, it only makes sense that one of these men would likely have been involved. Ray certainly wanted to have Brandy back in his life, and it isn't impossible to imagine that he could have confronted her and things could have gone very wrong very quickly. On the other hand, we have Zeke, who in the years since has shown himself to not have cooperated very much and to not have been steering clear of breaking the law. When you add it all together, you've got a recipe for disaster here, and when it comes to murder, love and jealousy are two of the oldest motives in the book. The first theory involved in this case suggests that Ray McAdams may have been involved in Brandy's disappearance. For the most part, Ray doesn't come off well whenever someone is talking about his relationship with Brandy. He made that disturbing statement to Donna about how he could kill Brandy, make her disappear, and no one would find her. Was that prophetic? Brandy allegedly told friends that she was afraid of Ray, and in the time since they'd separated, Ray hadn't shown any indications that he was planning on giving up on winning her back. It isn't hard to imagine that he could have grown frustrated, jealous, and even violent in response to Brandy rebuffing him time and again. According to Ray, on the night Brandy went missing, he was at a club known as the Plex. He had left his house sometime around 8 p.m., driven to the club, applied to be a bouncer, and hung out well into the early morning hours, not leaving until sometime between 1 and 2 a.m. This was confirmed by a friend who claimed to have been at the club with Ray that night. Of course, all of this was called into question when his sister-in-law and Brandy's close friend, Amy McAdams, told authorities that she had actually dropped some items off to Ray that night, around 9 or 9:30, and that he was home when she did so. It's pretty easy to see that Ray's accounting for his comings and goings that night wasn't accurate, but it really becomes a question of whether or not this was a lie told on purpose or on accident. If you went out one night and then 2 weeks later police ask you what time you'd gone out, would you be able to remember it with total accuracy? Some people would and others wouldn't. Being wrong about the times doesn't necessarily imply that Ray was guilty of anything, but what seems more disturbing about it is the fact that this information about the discrepancy didn't come out until Ray had passed away. Why was it kept secret? Was it because Brandy wasn't the only person who was afraid of Ray? Or was it because Amy simply didn't know that Ray had told the police he'd left his home at 8? That's a question we don't have an answer for at the moment, but it certainly caused a great deal of suspicion. It's also confusing because Amy has said she arrived at Brandy's apartment at 10:30, having worked overtime. How was she dropping off items to Ray if she was at work? Nothing makes a great deal of sense when it comes to this timeline. So assuming that Ray wasn't at the club as early as 8 p.m., that would certainly open the door to the possibility that he'd have time to visit Brandy, pick her up, and then who knows what. If indeed Brandy was dumped in the golf course, the Cooper River, or somewhere in that area, it wouldn't have been a long trip to make, and Ray would have easily been able to do so and be home in time for Amy to stop by. Then again, Brandy's voicemail was checked around 9, and a text message was sent to Zeke's phone at 10. If Ray had committed this crime, why would he bother checking her voicemail or texting Zeke? Also, he couldn't have been with Brandy at 9 if Amy visited him at home sometime between 9 and 9:30. This would mean that, were Ray involved, he'd have had to have been with Brandy sometime after 9:30. But according to witness Chevetta Johnson, Brandy exited her apartment and got into a red truck with a man between 9 and 9:30. The only way Ray could have been involved would be as if he abducted and murdered Brandy later in the evening or had someone helping him. This is where Zeke would come in. Some have suggested the possibility that the two men could have worked together to have done something to Brandy, but no one has yet been able to pin down a reason why. In the aftermath, both men pointed fingers at one another, and we know that their friendship had ended badly once Ray had become aware that there was a relationship between Brandy and Zeke. So why would Ray want the help of a man he now knows he could no longer trust in order to eliminate a woman that he loved and was trying to get back into his life? That aspect of it makes absolutely no sense. So could Ray have had someone else help him? Well, that's certainly a possibility, but in all the years that have passed, not a single person has ever said anything which directly ties Ray to Brandy's disappearance. Even Brandy's own mother, in the end, apologized to Ray for being so hard on him. She began to believe that Zeke had been involved, but Ray likely hadn't. So when you look at it, it's certainly possible Ray could have been involved, but the timeline is extremely tight, and he'd had to have had someone working with him on this. Unless he grabbed Brandy much later, but for that to have occurred, Chevetta Johnson would have had to have seen Brandy getting into a red truck, but not seen her go back into her apartment, nor seen Ray arriving later to abduct Brandy. Not to mention, no cell phone records exist to show communication between Ray and Brandy that evening, suggesting that if Ray did come and get Brandy, he'd have done so by simply showing up without any advance notice. Ray certainly has aspects about him that are suspicious. He seemed threatening, controlling, and intimidating. He made bizarre statements to Brandy's mother which is really never a good idea, and if even he was joking, it wasn't very funny. His truck was never examined forensically and since hasn't been located to test after the fact. But does that add up to murder? Ultimately, Ray remains a possibility, but when you're looking at this case and you're examining all the evidence and all of the details, there's a lot more that seems to be pointing towards Zeke than towards Ray. The one key item which seems to connect Ray to Brandy that night is the red truck, with the white stripe and the hockey mask attached to it. The problem is with that, in the months and years following her disappearance, Zeke worked overtime to try and make Ray appear to be the guilty party. If this was something he planned to do, it's not difficult to imagine he could have thrown a hockey mask on the grill of one of his work trucks, if for no reason other than to be identified by witnesses later as Ray McAdams. I know that seems like a stretch, but at the same time, look at how far Zeke went to try and lay the guilt on Ray. The guy called in fake tips to the police suggesting that Ray was the killer. Not exactly a genius, but not too stupid to not know how to set someone up. Ray remains a possibility, but really only in the shadow of Zeke Lankford. So that brings us to the second and final theory, that Zeke Lankford, without Ray McAdams, was involved in Brandy's disappearance. There are two forks to this theory. Firstly, that Zeke may have abducted Brandy and trafficked her to a drug dealer in Houston, Texas to pay off a debt. And secondly, that with the assistance of at least two other individuals, Zeke may have murdered Brandy and disposed of her body somewhere in the area of the abandoned naval base and the Cooper River. Beginning with the drug trade aspect, there's not a lot to support that theory. Sadly, it isn't unheard of for someone to use a living human being as payment for a drug debt. In many cases, this person will be trafficked to the drug dealer at some time where they will be used in a manner of ways to earn back money. In many cases, women are forced to use drugs, getting addicted to them, and then that addiction is used to force them into prostitution to earn money for the dealer. This is something that happens more than we'd like to imagine, and in the case of Brandy Hanna, it's not a possibility that can be completely dismissed. However, the more you look at this angle, the less likely it seems. Zeke didn't leave town, so he certainly didn't bring her to Houston. Now, if he did have two people working with him, they could have done this. But is it possible that 14 years later, there's been no evidence linked to this possibility other than a rumor told by Ray McAdams' father? Perhaps it's wrong to think so, but many people believe that if this tip had come from anyone other than McAdams, it might carry more weight. But it seems like yet another example of pointing fingers. Of course, if the McAdams family really wanted to put the screws to Zeke, why wouldn't they just say that they'd heard a rumor that he'd been involved in her murder? It's hard to know what exactly is going on here, but there's obviously a lot of bad blood and no way to know for sure. Applying Occam's razor, in which the simplest answer is usually the correct one, it's a lot easier to believe that Zeke could have been involved in Brandy's murder rather than involved in trafficking her. When it comes down to it, Sergeant Locker ultimately believes that Brandy was murdered, and as for the drug angle, he considers it a distant second in terms of theories. So that leads us to the second fork, that Zeke Lankford was in some way responsible for Brandy's murder. We know from text messages and phone calls that Brandy made that she'd been speaking with Zeke and he was possibly going to see her that night. At work, she told this to friends. In her last call to her mother, she confirmed that Zeke was possibly coming over. Zeke would later claim he had to work late, so he couldn't make it there, but then when his timesheet was showed and showed that he clocked out at 4 p.m., he admitted that he did see Brandy that night. The specifics of their interaction have never been fully released to the public, but once Zeke confirmed this, he gave himself a lot to answer for. We have nothing solid which puts Ray McAdams at Brandy's apartment that night. We have Zeke's own confession that he was there. This may link up with Chevetta Johnson seeing the red truck with the Jason mask on it, and if so, that would imply that Zeke was trying to set up Ray from the get-go. If he was willing to go far enough as to make his truck look like Ray's, it's difficult to imagine that he had anything other than negative intentions when he went to Brandy's apartment that night. Given the circumstances, that Brandy was planning to go to the beach that weekend and had made plans with Amy to go shopping that night, considering that all Brandy took out of the apartment with her was her cell phone and keys, it doesn't seem like she was planning to go anywhere else, and that the idea may have simply been to sit in Zeke's truck and talk. Zeke himself does no additional favors by behaving oddly in the weeks and months following her disappearance. He enters Brandy's apartment against Donna's request, but specifically what for? Was he looking to ensure there was nothing there to implicate him in the disappearance? We don't know how long he was inside the apartment, what he could have removed or what he could have placed there to steer attention away from himself. Since it was never designated as a crime scene, there was no testing for fingerprints, blood, or anything else which might have implicated Zeke in a crime. In a manner of speaking, if indeed he did something to her in that apartment that night, he got really lucky that it was never checked thoroughly. So we have Zeke going into the apartment against Donna's wishes, getting caught lying, and essentially destroying his alibi, and then, in another strange twist, the guy shows up to the search effort for Brandy. He doesn't show up to help, he doesn't contribute in any way, he just watches. He watches and asks that question about whether or not the dogs can detect Brandy if she's been buried. If that isn't a warning light, I don't know what is. It isn't uncommon for criminals to show up at crime scenes and searches. They aren't there to help. They're there to gather information on how the investigation is going and whether or not they have to worry. Zeke, apparently, was dumb enough to ask that incriminating question, to have been captured on camera present at the scene, and to have drawn enough attention to himself that investigators had to come to him and tell him not to come to the next search. In later years, we have Zeke's confession that he called in false tips, lied to investigators, and all of this results in the man being sentenced to 2 years in prison for obstruction of justice. Unlike Ray, who was seen by Amy that night and who apparently did attend the Plex Club, though later than he'd originally stated, we have absolutely nothing to account for Zeke's movements that night after 4 p.m., other than his own admission that he did see Brandy. Could he have texted himself from her phone in order to give himself the ability to say he wasn't there at that time and that she'd been texting him? For a guy who went so far out of his way to frame someone else, that can't be ruled out. Sergeant Locker said it best. Everything points to Lankford. From his lies, odd behaviors, the truck he drove, his attempts to frame Ray, and his evasiveness in the years after, this does not seem like the definition of a man who has nothing to hide. Bear in mind, both men took him past polygraphs, though Ray took his within 2 weeks of the disappearance, and Zeke put his off for nearly 2 months. Other than the fact that polygraphs are notoriously inaccurate, it isn't hard to see that if Zeke had wanted to take the test earlier, he could have, and that he may have been trying to buy himself time to either come up with good answers to the questions he'd be asked, or to try and figure out the best way to beat a polygraph. At this particular moment, there is not enough evidence to charge Zeke with murder. However, Sergeant Locker did receive a tip that Lankford and two others were involved in Brandy's disappearance. The tip was taken seriously enough that it led to interviews with Lankford in prison that resulted in the obstruction charges. We don't have a suggestion of who the two other men may have been, but it has been hinted here and there that they may not have been involved in the murder, but did take part in concealing Brandy's remains. If indeed this is the case, that means that, other than the tipster, who kept this information secret for more than 10 years, there may be two other people who have much more to add to this story. When you lay the two theories side by side, when you examine both men, there are pros and cons for each as to having been involved, but the scale tips heavily in Zeke's direction. For now, this case remains unsolved, but the investigation is active. Sergeant Locker has discussed it with the media as recently as December of 2018. It's ongoing. The search is underway, and given all the effort and time Locker has put into it for a case with very little to work with, he had put a tremendous amount of this puzzle together. The discovery of the shoe seems to suggest that Brandy was murdered and disposed of in the area, if indeed the shoe was Brandy's. While that can't be known for certain, it does seem like it'd be a hell of a coincidence if it wasn't. As for now, the North Charleston police are looking for anyone who has information about Brandy's disappearance and who may be able to identify the two men Zeke Lankford was alleged to have been working with the night Brandy Hanna vanished. This is a terrible story. Watching interviews with Donna Parent is emotionally overwhelming, You can see the pain on her face and hear it in her voice. Her beloved daughter went missing nearly 14 years ago, when she was 32. If alive today, Brandy would be turning 47 in November. What could she have been by now? A mother? A wife? Anything she put her mind to? And yet all of that was stolen away in a night lost somewhere in the fog and smoke of confusion, lies, and betrayal. The disappearance of Brandy Hannah remains unsolved, though unlike many cases, this one is no longer so cold and has been heating up. We can only hope that sometime, sooner than later, authorities will find the evidence they need, someone will present them with details they have been seeking, or Zeke Langford will finally tell them everything he knows. Until then, this case remains open, unsolved, but actively under investigation. If you're looking for more information about the disappearance of Brandy Hannah, there are many websites and forums discussing her case. The Post and Courier has written several articles following her story, and Disappeared featured her story several years ago. If you have any information about the disappearance of Brandy Hannah, please contact Sergeant Ron Locker of the North Charleston Police Department at area code 843-300-8241. What do you believe happened? Tweet me at TraceEvPod, message me on Instagram at TraceEvidencePod, email me at TraceEvidencePod@gmail.com, or comment in the Facebook group. A special thank you goes out to Patreon producers Amanda Lee Ruth Smith, Krista Colvin, D'Earthy, Diane Dyson, Eamon Brady, Kate Alexander, Megan Cotter, Tara Doble, and the Reigns of Yesteryear. If you're interested in supporting Trace Evidence, please visit patreon.com/traceevidence. Visit trace-evidence.com for all episodes, social media links, merchandise, and more. I want to thank you all for listening to this episode, and remind you that if you're planning to attend CrimeCon in New Orleans, to use the promo code TRACE19 for 10% off a standard badge. I'll be on Podcast Row and can't wait to meet all of you. I hope you'll join me next week for another unsolved case on the next episode of Trace Evidence.